Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Greetings, my beautiful friends. I'm excited. I'm very excited. You know what? I'm not excited. I hate that term, by the way. Excited. I'm excited. It's a very Western thing to say that you're excited, and that's a good thing. To refer to yourself like you're a can of Diet Coke that somebody shook up. I'm happy. Is that a better way to say it? I'm enthusiastically invigorated by today's guest, Hamilton Morris, a true luminary in the psychedelic universe who has created an amazing series called Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. For those of you familiar with it, you probably are aware that he now has a third season, which is available on Amazon. And if you haven't had the good fortune to see it yet, you'll be thrilled to hear that it's, as far as I'm concerned, the best season yet. He's so funny and so brilliant and so good at capturing different facets of psychedelic culture, and also sort of shotgunning just random, interesting facts throughout every single episode. And on top of that, the show has insane production quality. It's just a beautiful show. It's got amazing animation. It's got just, they spend a lot of time on their setups and their lighting, and all of it just combines to make it a beautiful gift to the planet. And I'm not just saying that because he took an hour and a half out of what I'm sure is his very busy schedule, because on top of being a TV personality, a producer, and a writer, he is also a working chemist, which is incredible to think about the fact that he's a TV star who probably also knows how to make LSD. Does that make him the coolest person on Earth? Definitely makes him one of them. And he's here with us today. We're going to jump right into this episode, but first, some quick business. A tremendous thank you to ExpressVPN, the great liberators of the internet, for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. My loves, you might not be aware of this, but there are many shows that you can't see. ExpressVPN actually lets you change your online location so you can control where you want sites to think you're located, and it is weirdly empowering. I don't know why it makes me feel so gleeful, but it does. There's a real feeling of like, holy shit, this is incredible. My Google is now in German. I just like it. But even better, you will have access to all kinds of shows that you normally can't watch. It works with any streaming service, Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube. And the best thing about it, ExpressVPN, is it's easy and it works. There's no complicated install. You just install it, run it, choose where you want to be, and you're there. Plus, it's fast. You can stream in HD, no problem, no buffering or lag, and it's compatible with all your devices, phones, laptops, media, consoles, smart TV, and more. Not only does it let you change your location, it also encrypts your data and lets you surf the web safely and anonymously. And these days, that's important. Go to expressvpn.com/Duncan to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/Duncan. Thanks, ExpressVPN. And now an excerpt from The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva.
If with mindfulness is rope, the elephant of mind is gathered all around, our fears will come to nothing. Every virtue drop into our hands. Tigers, lions, elephants, and bears, snakes, and every hostile foe. those who guard the prisoners in hell, ghosts and ghouls and every evil wraith. By simple binding of this mind alone, all these things are likewise bound. By simple taming of this mind alone, all these things are likewise tamed. For all anxiety and fear, and pain in boundless quantity, their source and wellspring is the mind itself.
That's Way of the Bodhisattva. It was translated by the Dalai Lama and read by Woolston Fletcher. It's available on Audible. You should definitely listen to it. Not just because the narrator sounds like a character out of Demon Souls, but also because it presents a variety of compelling arguments for the possibility that the you that you think you are is not you at all. And that's what I always loved about LSD. That's what I always loved about psychedelics, was that moment where the identity is annihilated by the tsunami of the psychedelic. And somewhere in that annihilation, an entire new universe appears, as though whatever the you thought you were was actually some kind of blindfold that the universe was wearing. And The Way of the Bodhisattva has a lot of chapters that you might find useful. If you're somebody like me and you have anger problems, if you're tormented by anger, it's got an entire chapter on how to deal with that, on the antidote for anger, which is patience. And also, just because I love horror movies and I love the Hellraiser movies, it's got some amazingly vivid descriptions of the hell realms. And it mentions more than once the janitors of hell, which is an interesting idea. Like, I had no idea hell had janitors. But I guess it would need, somebody would have to be there to like clean up the blood and mop up the sizzling guts. Speaking of sizzling guts, I would like to invite you to head over to patreon.com/DTFH. And a big thank you to all the people who have recently subscribed to the Patreon. Because I'm doing a kind of paternity leave, you have not experienced the full glory of the DTFH Patreon, which you will begin to experience again next week. Starting Monday, I'll be back to guiding our weekly group meditation, Journey into Boredom. And on Friday, we'll resume our Friday family gatherings. And then starting again in March will be our book club. We have yet to pick that title. But if you want to jump into the DTFH community, if you want piles of glorious, fragrant, vivid, beautiful, powerful, slightly pungent content, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/DTFH. Not only will you have access to commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, but if you stick around long enough, you will get exclusive merchandise, a beautiful mug, a sticker, an incredible t-shirt. Go check us out. It's at patreon.com/DTFH. Friends, we've got a wonderful podcast for you today. Returning to the DTFH, the host of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia, welcome, Hamilton Morris. Hamilton, welcome back to the DTFH. It's so great to hear your voice.
Thanks for having me.
I always love talking with you, and I really am grateful to you for the sending me all the episodes of season 3 of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia, now available on Amazon. What was the service it was on prior to Amazon? Hulu?
It's a hard show for people to find. It's very frustrating for me. The majority of the messages that I get are from people trying to figure out how to watch it. And I can't help people in that way, because I don't even know. It depends on where you are. The easiest way, if you're in the US, is to just watch it on Amazon. You can also buy it for, I think, $2 an episode on YouTube. And people have been have been like pirating it and putting it on YouTube, which I think is great. Like, I just want people to watch it. The only issue is the people that pirate it do a terrible job and cut out pieces and like splice in soccer games and do things to get over whatever copyright bots. So that just on the level of people not seeing the entire episode, I really discourage people from watching those pirated ones. But it's also on iTunes. I hope it will be on Hulu at some point. I have no idea when. No one will tell me. And it's on TV as well for people that I don't have a TV. But I guess if you have a TV, it's available on Vice TV and in some cable packages.
Not to start off with a pretty mundane technical question, but are you producing these yourself? Or who are you making these with?
Yeah, I mean, I am the writer and director of the show, and I make it with a small, closely knit group of people who help with every facet of the editing and the photography and the sound mix and the color correction and things like that. But it's made by a very small number of people, considering... And doing this over the pandemic as well was, you know, like a really bizarre filmmaking exercise. But yeah, it is something I'm doing myself. Sometimes people are actually right now very confused by how things are made. Like,
yes,
like they are very detached from the act of creation. And so they often attribute creative agency to corporations. They're like, why did Vice make this? Or why did Vice do this? It's like, Vice is a logo. Vice doesn't exist. Why are you getting angry at a logo? Or why are you praising a logo? Like, these are not, like, they're human beings that create these things, and their names are in the credits. But then on top of that, I feel all these streaming services like Netflix and Amazon, they actually cut the credits out of a lot of episodes now, which I think exacerbates this problem of people not even being aware of the act of creation. They don't on some level even think about what it means to make something.
I want to praise whatever logo or non-logo has, you know, been part of making this show, because it is so good. The animation is amazing. Some people who maybe haven't seen Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia, you might think that it's monolithic in subject matter. It's just about drugs or something. It isn't. It's like a shotgun scattering of fascinating facts, and it's just so you've done such a good job editing it. It just looks so pretty. So thanks for making it. I love it.
Yeah, thank you. And the reason I even bring up this credit thing, which I understand may sound like a weird, pedantic note to begin the conversation with, is because it was insanely difficult to make, and I can't name all of the people that were involved, but their names are in the credits, and it was a real labor of love to do it. I mean, this was not a job for many of the people. I had to work for, or I chose to work for, you know, 4 months unpaid to get it done, and it's because a lot of the people were just very passionate about the subject matter and getting these stories told.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You know, I have a kind of sentimental feeling when it comes to shows with the subject matter of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia, specifically psychoactive substances, which is that anytime a show revolving around that subject is against it, I mean, instant hate of the thing, because it's embarrassing to watch. It feels like some kind of, you know, throwback to the war on drugs. But when it's pro the subject matter, and it's made poorly, then you get that effect of like, well, I mean, they're whatever, stoners or acid heads, or they're people who are psychonauts or whatever you want to call it. And because of that, their show sucks. So anytime you get like a kind of a great show meeting something that is not anti psychoactive substances, I think it benefits everybody because it shows, yeah, you can, I mean, the opening of the xenon gas episode, you're inhaling a balloon of a gas that I'd only vaguely heard of and had no idea it was psychoactive. Incredible. Do you ever feel like you're putting yourself in danger doing this?
No. And I think that is sort of an interesting question, is there's often, at least in terms of the consumption of the psychoactive substances, there's often this idea that it's very dangerous. There are very dangerous things that happen in the show, but the consumption of the psychoactive drugs is not one of them, I would say. There may be in the Xenon Clinic, there were some things that were questionable. That's a whole long story. I don't know, like, it's a bit of a tangent. We can get into that. But the consumption itself is often something that's done very carefully because, you know, I think for so long people have associated drug use with self-destruction. Like, they consider, yes, even people that enjoy drugs, even people that are in favor of drugs, that think that they should be legal, that think they should be researched, many of those people still on some level believe that the use of a psychoactive drug is self-destructive. And I think that one of the major things that I try to communicate is it doesn't need to be that way. And you can use these things in a way that is not only not destructive, but constructive. It actually will help you. It will make you better than you were. And and I think that that's an important lesson. Of course, not all use is like that, and it requires an enormous amount of discipline and research and care in order to achieve the best effect from these experiences. But I think it's just important to keep that in mind, that this is not something that people need to be ashamed of or think is inherently bad for any reason.
I love psychoactive substances. They have been a huge benefit in various parts of my life. But Hamilton, I cannot get the effect of growing up during the war on drugs out of my head. There is always some underlying sense of doing something wrong, of, you know, that this is somehow getting off the track of what a life should be. And these are things that I passionately love. Do you have that in you at all?
Yes.
Or did you have it?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. I think, and I don't think it's even just the war on drugs. I think that it's also capitalism. And also, it's not an entirely unreasonable idea to have, because we are taught that, not even just taught, we live in a capitalist society, for better or worse, where productivity is prized above all else. And anything that interferes with productivity is not good in our society, regardless of how it makes you feel. So, you know, my own, I would say the thing that I struggle with the most is cannabis. I, without question, enjoy smoking it, but I have never been able to fully overcome a sort of shame or guilt associated with using it. And for that reason, I use it infrequently, because no matter how much I enjoy it, no matter how beneficial or relaxing it is for me, I still can't entirely shake this sense that it would be better if I were sober reading. It would be better if I were studying. It would be better if I were writing. Is it truly permissible for me just to feel good and just relax and have a conversation or watch a movie?
Yeah, that's it. I think we're hopefully some of the last generations to be poisoned in that way. And I'm hoping by the time my kids are old enough to, safely use any of these substances, that the propaganda mechanism will have worn down and we'll have the data available to show that it's beneficial. But yeah, wow. So I guess that's just something we're going to have to deal with for the rest of our lives.
And it impacts the experience itself. I mean, people often think of the placebo effect as something that exists entirely independently from the pharmacological action of drugs, but the sense of those drugs that we have impacts the experience. So if you grow up in a culture that says using LSD is therapeutic and beneficial and may actually make you a better person, you can be sure that that user will have a better LSD experience than someone who calls it acid, conceptualizes the experience as frying their brain, calls the experience frying, thinks that it's a poison of some kind. I mean, even if you're having the best experience of your life, if that's in the background, you can't fully enjoy it in the same way that I can't, you know, I could eat the most delicious meal from McDonald's in the world, but I am still thinking about it as a, like, unethical, poisonous material, regardless of what it actually is. You know, I haven't, you know, done deep personal research into the nutritional value of fast food, but my intuitive sense of it is that it's bad and should be avoided. And so I could, you know, maybe someone could sneak an extra healthy, ethically raised piece of meat into my McDonald's hamburger with like a carefully baked bun, but I would still feel ashamed eating it because of this sense that it is bad and should be avoided.
Yep. I can't do it. I can't pull off. I can't have a happy meal. Like, no matter what's happening, I'm always disgusted with myself if I'm eating McDonald's, no matter how good it tastes. So I was thinking about what the questions I have for you now that you're three seasons in to this incredible show. And I know that you're a person who is constantly researching, and like you get literally into the atomic depths of these substances and the way they affect our consciousness. And I've been loosely following some of the research that's happening currently regarding implanting memories in creatures. And the implications of that, to me, are wonderful on one level, in the sense of learning and expediting certain kinds of training or God. It goes on and on. But on another level, it's the first time I've really sort of had an inner shudder, like a Aldous Huxley sense of like, oh my God, is this the next wave of psychedelics that we're going to have memories implanted and removed, meaning that this entire war on drugs problem theoretically could somehow be pharmaceutically softened or altered. Anyway, the question is, if you, and I'm sorry, I know this is a terrible thing to ask people, especially in these days of technological acceleration, but do you have any prognostications regarding what types of psychedelics might be in our future?
Yes. the final episode of my show aired last night, and it profiled a brilliant pharmacologist named Brian Roth. Have you heard his name before?
I have not.
He's a really interesting guy, and he's one of these scientists who has done a lot of work that if you didn't know better, you'd think it was science fiction. He was crucial in developing a technology called DREAD, DREADD, that stands for designer receptors exclusively activated by designer drugs. And his idea was, you know, in traditional pharmacology, one of the most important goals is to develop drugs that are selective for one receptor and only one receptor. Because when you look at a drug like Ibogaine or DMT or mescaline or many of the drugs that people are aware of, they often are promiscuous in their binding. They have activity at a variety of different receptors, and it makes it hard to study the causal relationship pharmacologically, because if a drug is acting on several different receptors, how do you know what receptor is responsible for what physiological, neurological effect? So if you can come up with a drug that is exclusively binding to one receptor, it's a very useful pharmacological tool, but it's hard. I mean, there are people that spend their entire careers trying to develop a drug that exclusively binds to the serotonin 2A receptor or the serotonin 2B receptor, or so on and so forth.
What are those receptors responsible for?
one is considered the primary site of psychedelic action. That's the serotonin 2A receptor. The 2B okay. receptor is considered an undesirable target of some drugs that causes excessive growth of heart valves, actually. So, but anyway, so this guy, Brian Roth, his idea was, okay, what if we sidestep this entire issue? And instead of trying to develop high selectivity drugs, we develop high selectivity receptors. Receptors in a brain that exclusively are activated by one drug and only one drug. And we reverse engineer the, basically reverse engineer the brain for the drug instead of the drug for the brain.
Whoa.
Yeah. And that, and this is not, and this is something he has actually done that scientists are currently using. It's not an entire brain of neurons. It's one receptor, but this is the idea. So there are these amazing things that are being done. And then he's taken that a step further where if you know the molecular structure of a receptor, you know every amino acid residue and how it is three-dimensionally arranged, you can then, based on the charge of those residues and their shape, you can, using AI, generate artificial drugs and bind those artificial drugs to the artificial receptor. So you're doing basic pharmacology research, but it's entirely in silico. There's no actual proteins and there's no actual drugs. You're just docking virtual drugs onto a virtual receptor. But because you don't have to go to the trouble of synthesizing a drug or isolating a receptor protein, you can look at the pharmacology of 10 million drugs a day. So using this technology, he has, and he hasn't published it for 2A yet, but he claims to have developed entirely new scaffolds for psychedelics. That is, you know, traditionally the psychedelics are fall into a couple of structural classes, ergolines, tryptamines, phenethylamines, but hypothetically they could have totally different structures that haven't been discovered yet. So he's using computers to discover new drugs on a virtual receptor. And you know, that's one of these things. It's just, you know, what is that going to do in the future? Who knows? But right. it's very exciting. And I think we are on the precipice of a lot of great discoveries.
This matches one of Nick Bostrom's predictions for how a superintelligence might come to the planet, which is some interaction with an AI and some kind of genetic shift in like the human nervous system to increase, amplify whatever type of intelligence you want to amplify. So that is wild to think about. But just to jump back for a second, you said in silico, as in it's okay. So that means just it's just happening in a computer. It's like what they're doing with protein folding right now, but with psychoactive chemicals.
Yeah.
Whoa, that is wild. This is one of the, much like, I mean, even though every, you know, people are talking about AI as being the future, there just can never be enough emphasis on how it's going to transform culture. But the addition of AI interacting with the genetic engineering of the human brain, do you mean, so you're saying there's the possibility of having an open brain surgery, or how would you change your own brain in a way that it would become receptive or a receptor to these artificial chemicals?
Nobody has done that yet, but I think hypothetically you would probably inject a virus into the brain that would cause a transcriptional change that would cause the receptors to produce these new designer proteins.
So what you're talking about there is also like a nightmare bioweapon, which is a virus that causes a change in the human brain that pairs with a chemical weapon that induces states of consciousness.
I mean, yes, there are certainly potentially nefarious uses for this technology, assuming that it could even work that way. I mean, that's the problem with a lot of these things, like the you know, implantation of memories in a snail, or dread technology being used as a weapon, or things like that, is that often it's just hard. It's much harder to do these things than people realize. You know, on one hand, you have the Nick Bostroms of the world that are talking about super intelligence. And then on the other hand, you have an iPhone in 2021 that can't autocorrect I am to I apostrophe M.
Yeah, right. Right. But, you know, we, you know, but just thinking in terms of, like steam engines to the bullet trains in Japan, you know, and the span of time between them is, you know, based on universal time, not that long at all. But on, in human time, what is it? It's like almost a lifetime between those two transformations in a technology. But still, this thing, even if it is 50, 30 years into the future, it's we're talking about a kind of apocalypse. I mean, sometimes I think about the amount of time that gets put into anyone getting good at anything, and how the compression of that time is going to create genius like we've never seen before, mixed in with a kind of terrible hubris. You know, there's some humiliation that has to happen in any path towards learning something. It fucks with your ego enough that hopefully by the time you get good at anything, you have some humility. But remove that gap of time via some pharmacological technology, and suddenly we're going to have a planet filled with these hyper-talented beings that never have encountered the learning curve. I don't mean to get too, like, weird and into and I don't know why I'm getting so negative with you, Hamilton. But do you know what I mean? All I'm saying is, when we think about on the horizon of history, what's coming our way, it is so bizarre to imagine that we are potentially 10 years, 15 years away from consuming a substance that transforms the way that we see ourselves by implanting memories that are healthy memories, or even analyzing past memories and correcting them enough that they no longer, that we're not beating ourselves up anymore. Do you ever, like, worry about that? That there is some potential for a dystopian pharmacological future for our species?
I mean, I think we're already in a dystopian pharmacological future. I think that there's a lot of room for improvement where we currently are. You know, there's some enormous percentage of the American population taking SSRI antidepressants. I think it's something like 15% of American women, something close to that. It seems like it's a lot more in New York. In New York, it seems like it's a solid third of women that I meet take SSRIs. And I, of course, understand that for some people, it's beneficial. I'm not going to say that no one should use SSRIs. I don't think that. But I think that very few people that use SSRIs are extremely happy about it. You know, I don't. It's very rare for me to meet someone who says, "Yeah, I take Prozac and I love it. It's fantastic. Right. I'm so happy that Prozac entered my life. I am so grateful for Prozac. I want to take it forever. It's been the best thing that ever happened to me." It's usually a kind of begrudging, "Well, it's better than the way I was before. It's a necessary evil." Right. And, you know, I think that we can do better. I think we can do a lot better. And I have hope for that. In terms of dystopian futures of implanted memories, I don't know. You know, it's very easy to look at the headlines of these articles and not look at what's actually being done. And what's actually being done, it's like, you know, they're doing some, it's not a memory in the sense that you or I think of a memory. It's some, like, extremely minimal impulse in a snail that that is very different from what we would call memory. That's not to say that it's impossible. It probably is possible and probably will occur at some point. I imagine not in either of our lifetimes, but when it happens, I hope that we are mature enough to use these things constructively.
What are your thoughts regarding ketamine in the treatment of depression as compared to the SSRI?
Well, yeah, I mean, related to what I was just saying, you know, there's a little bit of a crisis in psychiatry in that there have been so many years where we haven't had a dramatically new treatment for depression. And I think the FDA started to liberalize its criteria a little bit because actually the clinical data for ketamine were not all that impressive compared to placebo. It wasn't, at least in terms of the clinical trials that were done, it was not a miracle cure for depression. And really the only way that they were able to get it approved was by making it a fast-tracked breakthrough therapy for treatment-resistant depression, which is justifiably considered a life-threatening disease like cancer. And so there are special designations available for diseases that are life-threatening where they can liberalize the criteria slightly to allow new therapies to be introduced to the market for conditions that could really benefit from them. And ketamine is a complicated one. Yeah, I haven't been following every new piece of clinical data that emerges, but it seems like it anecdotally does help a lot of people. I certainly also know people who haven't been helped and have been harmed by it. And I think that because it's a psychedelic, it might require a different strategy than is typically used for antidepressants, and one that is not really part of our current medical framework, because we're so used to this idea of an antidepressant is a drug that you take every day, or in the case of ketamine, I think typically every week or every second week. And we associate one-off use of a psychoactive drug with non-medical recreational use. But I do wonder if that type of strategy makes the most sense for ketamine. I think it's funny the way that like so-called abuse or non-medical use is converging with medical orthodoxy, where, you know, 4 years ago, if you'd told a medical doctor, I snort ketamine to treat my depression, they would say, you know, that's irresponsible. That's not the way that you use ketamine. It's not okay to snort it. It's not a recognized antidepressant. Now, Johnson & Johnson sells a nasal spray of ketamine to treat depression. But, you know, in my own use of ketamine as an antidepressant, which I haven't done in years, but in 2018, I was very depressed and used it 3 times that year. And I think that the way that I used it was actually very beneficial, which wasn't to use it as a daily antidepressant or a weekly antidepressant, but to use it as a kind of one-off tool to break out of a ingrained thought pattern that was disrupting my functioning.
If you had to describe the K-hole, how would you talk about it? What is that place?
I mean, it's not easy to describe. And it's not easy to remember, and it's not something that is analogous to anything in normal consciousness. It's not analogous to a dream. It's maybe somewhat close to a waking, sort of lucid type dream sometimes, but even then it's hard to say. It seems like a very random rearrangement of your consciousness that has elements that feel like what I imagine schizophrenia feels like, where there's a sort of grandiose sense of privileged understanding of the mechanism of the universe that other people don't appreciate.
Yeah.
Or a privileged understanding of genetics and inheritance and genealogy and all these kinds of, you start thinking about, you know, connecting wires of your life and your lineage and society in these very abstract, weird ways that if you describe them to another person, it would sound like a sort of typical schizophrenic delusion. And that I don't know if that is the beneficial aspect of it. I think what is really interesting about ketamine is that I think that when you're depressed and you've been depressed for a while, you can get locked into a certain type of thinking that is pessimistic, basically, and one that has a very limited view of the world, where you think, this is who I am. I'm this guy. This is what I do. This is what I'm good at. This is what I'm bad at. And I don't do these other things, and I don't have any hope of doing those other things because this is who I am, and what today was like is what tomorrow will be like, and the day after, and that's just my lot. And when you take ketamine, it can give you a delusional sense of possibility. The aperture of possibility expands dramatically, and suddenly all of the restrictions that you once thought existed disintegrate, and you can feel that, okay, oh, I want to be a politician? I guess I'll be a politician then. Oh, I should write a novel tomorrow. I guess I'll be a movie star. I'll be a medical doctor. I'll be whatever. And if you're depressed, that sounds delusional. Be a politician? How on earth could I be a politician? That makes no sense. But then in that state, you think, why not? Well, every politician had to begin with the thought, I can be a politician. So the first step of becoming a politician is to think that you can be a politician. And so I actually think that that, you know, delusional or potentially delusional self-image can be very therapeutic for people that have a overly restrictive view of themselves and what is possible. Because you do need that moment of thinking, I can do this in order to do something. And so even if it is delusional, that's the first step in expanding yourself. When this becomes problematic is when you do it all the time. Because I think as a one-off thing, every now and then, it can be tremendously beneficial to expand the scope of possibility of yourself. But if you're doing it all the time, then you can just end up having a totally distorted self-image that is not therapeutic or beneficial in any way. And that, I think, 100%. is the both the therapeutic psychological component of ketamine and what makes it dangerous.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear you say this because I never considered that facet of it, which is, it's not like the cocaine confidence. It's something entirely different. And for me, artistically, it was one of the most inspiring psychoactive substances I've ever encountered. And it informed a lot of the show I made called The Midnight Gospel. But I got addicted to it. I had to I got habituated to it, ended up having to flush it down the toilet. It stopped working. You know, to me, that's the main problem, exactly what you're saying, which is, you know, you can't just live a life of thinking that you're enlightened or inspired. You need to go through revision, you know? You need to go through the work part too. But that's interesting to hear you say that. You know, the delusional part though, this is, and we've had this conversation before, and I love how rational you are, and we need it. And I love how logical you are. And also I love how, you know how to create these things. You're an actual chemist, which is incredible. But I was just reading some, you know, I don't know, a blog or something regarding people who are researching psychoactive chemicals currently, and that if they if they announce that they've been using them, then their research is kind of not looked upon in the same light. Or even worse, if these people are using the chemicals that they're studying and having these experiences that are, you know, when I think of ketamine, I think of Buddhism, I think of the dissolution of the identity and some kind of experience of the gap between thoughts or something. You know, that's as far as I've gotten with it, or a Bardo state. But I'm allowed to do that because I'm a podcaster. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about any brushes you've had with what people would call the mystical and how your mind integrates that into your life.
Yeah. I mean, I think people often get confused when I say that I'm a materialist or that I don't believe in or that I'm not spiritual. And I'm not saying that I don't have amazing experiences that I cannot describe. I'm not saying that I live in some kind of, you know, sterile reality that is free of any astonishment. It's all I'm saying is that I don't feel the need to invoke the supernatural to explain things. I'm also not saying that I feel those things are at this time sufficiently explained by science. It's really just my way of saying, of trying to communicate that sometimes there is no explanation, and I would prefer not to use the supernatural to explain things that way. But there are all kinds of, you know, back to the ketamine example. I mean, I remember the last time I used it, maybe three years ago, I believe, I had this sort of immersive vision of myself at the Telluride Mushroom Festival. And it was this very boring memory. It was, you know, it's strange to simultaneously have this, you know, basically an out-of-body experience where you're dropped into a memory that you thought you'd forgotten that is so immersive it feels like reality, but that is also a boring memory. It's not a memory of, you know, some kind of extremely important moment in your life. It's totally mundane, or so it seemed. And I came out of it and I thought, wow, that was so mundane, just a memory of myself walking down a road in Telluride, Colorado after going mushroom hunting. Why would I even think of that? And then the more I thought about it, it started to sort of unfold, and the importance of it started to become apparent emotionally. And I thought, how is that even possible? How is it possible that by antagonizing this protein in my brain, I relive a memory so boring that even I don't recognize its significance at the time that I'm experiencing it or re-experiencing it, and then subsequently I'm able to recognize that it carried some kind of implicit message that was valuable to me? Like, you know, these are very strange experiences. It's very strange. And how, you know, how like, for, you know, if I use DMT, one thing that's totally remarkable to me is how good the things that I think are. Like, they are so good that I am puzzled by how good they are. Like, you know, the importance of love, the importance of kindness, the importance of generosity, the importance of gratitude. Why on earth would dimethyltryptamine binding to this subtype of serotonin receptor cause me to suddenly feel these extremely positive values of all things? You know, you could think it could just as easily be that I like salty foods, or, you know, that like I need a new couch or like whatever. But instead it's like, love your family, one day they'll be gone. You know, like, how does that happen? I don't know. Science has not explained it. I don't think spirituality explains it either. I think it's unknown. And I would love to learn even the smallest morsel of how that comes to be.
Well, you know, I've gotten so into meditation lately, and I've gotten so into Buddhism lately, that the best spiritual explanation I have for it, and forgive me anyone listening who disagrees or is a Buddhist, or I'm totally wrong, because, you know, I'm just going jogging in the woods and listening to like Audible Buddhist books. But there's an idea in Buddhism that humans are fundamentally good. That's a controversial idea, but that's the idea that everything else, everything a human does that involves hurting other people is of just an ignorance of what we really are, which is sort of an interconnected matrix of energy that doesn't have any lasting or integral self. And somehow there's a reality that's just, you know, for lack of a better word, and is a lazy thing to call it, just good. I'm sure there's some Tibetan word that would make more sense. So the answer could be, if we're looking at it from a spiritual lens, that these substances are kind of, you know, wiping off the windshield or something, enough that what you actually are starts coming out. And that, you know, maybe gets sort of animated or you know, configured based on the substance itself, but it's the reason that's the message these things seem to keep giving us isn't necessarily that it's the substance that has encoded in it compassion, but that we're fundamentally compassionate. That's just my current thinking on it, but who knows?
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree that the substance does not contain information. It's not the substance. And I would hope that you're right, that we're fundamentally compassionate. I mean, that would really be good if that's what's behind it all inside each of us.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that is, well, it's good, but then also it's, I think the beautiful thing about, I mean, it is good, but the beautiful thing about, like, I'm getting into these super obscure Buddhist scriptures, and they're wild, man. They're wild, but it's so annihilatory on one level, you know, so much of like a human suffering. And I think this answers the ketamine depression question to some degree. It's like so much of our suffering is just what you were saying. We're all wound up in ourself, in our bodies, you know, or it's a bummer when you get to a certain age, your body starts hurting. You look weirder and weirder every year. And so at least I do. Not maybe not you, actually, you look great, man. But like, you know what I mean? So a dissociative, it like sort of temporarily takes off this thing, or at least loosens it a little bit, that we call our identity, which if you really think about it, it's really interesting that, you know, whatever that thing is really just what we tend to pull out of the environment and notice, you know? And so maybe there's just in suddenly no longer pulling out the same constant, you know, aspects of reality that we've become habituated to pulling out, you know, maybe there's just some relief in suddenly seeing the world just as it is, you know, or a warped version of the world. There's freedom in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I don't know that this has ever been studied or even looked at very carefully, but a very large number of people that I know who are transgender have also used a lot of ketamine, and they have felt the ketamine was something that like helped them loosen the boundaries of their gender self-image. And I think that that's another example of what I was talking about is, you know, maybe you're unhappy and every single day, the reason that you're unhappy is you think, oh, it's because I'm a man or whatever. And then you take ketamine and you realize, oh, I'm not anything. I can be right. Whatever. I can be a medical doctor, and I can be a woman, and I could be 50 other things if I want to. I mean, you know, John Lilly toward the end, I think it was sort of, he was kind of an early adopter. But I'm under the impression that toward
breast
the end
implants.
Of, yeah, breast implants. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely that's, I think one of the, you know, evolutionary qualities of that particular drug. And the reason that like when people take it, some people dislike it because it has this sort of sci-fi quality to it. You know, it has a weird technological aspect to it, and that some people, you know, people like this sort of warm glow of mushrooms, but sometimes with ketamine, you really go into the void. And yeah, I think something in that melting down of the self, it's not just like suddenly you realize like, holy shit, there's no reason I can't become a poet or a doctor or learn to fly an airplane or, you know, what it's also, you realize like, why am I so fixated on my gender being the thing, you know, why am I so fixated on any quality of myself, you know, being like who I am? And that makes it a very controversial substance in that regard. But, you know, I want to swing around for a moment just because, And I'm sorry if this makes you feel uncomfortable, but you are like in the psychedelic universe, you're a rock star, man. And I was like, one of my favorite things that you do on Twitter, I love your social media presence, but sometimes you'll like show someone's tattoo of like DMT or whatever. They think it's DMT and you're like, actually. And then you'll say what it is. It's some either like completely benign something or like aspirin or something like that. But and I love that. I love the way you interact with people in the psychedelic world. But not to be scandalous, I wonder if you could maybe tell a story of some weird interactions you must have had with people out there who are, you know, tweaking out and have decided that you're Jesus?
Oh, I mean, I have them on a daily basis. I have them too frequently, in fact. And it's because over the last couple months, my show has been airing. I'm getting, 100 messages a day. And there's a lot of really strange people out there, as you know. And, I've gotten the full spectrum of people, someone telling me that their girlfriend is pregnant with the second coming of Jesus, and what can they do? How can I help spread awareness so that the world knows? You get that sort of thing. You get people to think they are Jesus, of course. You have people that are convinced that various psychoactive substances are having some kind of transhumanist ultra positive effect on them, but they actually seem to be in the throes of one of these sorts of delusions that we've just described. That's actually a pretty common one, and that goes to show how I think that actually represents one of the central problems with psychoactive drugs is you can think that they're helping you, but that's very different from them helping you. And I think that's actually one of the most important reasons to try to use them as infrequently as possible, is it will aid that self-assessment. Because if you're constantly in the throes of it, you can easily lose track of who you are and how you relate to who you used to be and where you're going. So, it's very tricky. And
Hamilton, when I told my wife at one point after I had gotten out of the ketamine's grip, I was like, but you know what? It was helping me make music. And the look on her face said everything. She's like, you think it was helping you make music? And then I went back and listened to some of the music I was making. Horrible. But in the midst of the haze I was in, I was like, this is cutting edge. And it was not. So yeah, I hear you, man. I've experienced it, and it's I'm lucky. It's just embarrassing, but it can get much worse.
So I didn't even know that this had happened with you. Maybe you've probably talked about this in past podcasts. So I don't know if it's something you want to rehash, but I'm just sort of curious because I've actually been hearing about a lot of people, especially over the pandemic, who have gotten very seriously into dissociatives, both ketamine and nitrous oxide. I used to never hear about nitrous oxide addiction among just my acquaintances. And in the last few months, I've casually heard people reference having to have multiple nitrous oxide interventions. Was this something that you were going through during the pandemic, or is this more distant past?
It was in the past more, but yeah, it's classic addiction. It just snuck up on me. It started off just like what we were I was just excited because it to me, it is a kind of visionary substance and wildly alien, and it sort of checks all the boxes in what I love about psychedelics. And also it's 45 minutes, so you're not committing to a 6 or 8 or 12 hour trip, which is really delightful. But then, just, it's nothing new, just a classic story. It wasn't even working anymore. But I was doing it all the time, all day long. It was embarrassing. I was getting that, I've been addicted to a few things in my life. I got physically addicted to benzos a long time ago when I was on a long comedy tour because I was taking them to go to sleep. But then I also started taking them in the day, and I only had maybe a 4 week supply, but I wasn't quite aware of how they can get their hooks into you. And so I just went, I went through withdrawals. It was the most fucked up. I got lucky. It was just 24, 48 hours. But, and then ketamine, it was more nefarious in that it doesn't seem to be, it's not physically addictive, but you get really it's like cigarettes, which are physically addictive. I just got habituated and it wasn't working. The last time I did it, over a year ago, it took me 4.5 hours to do a commercial for my podcast. And I just realized this is not only is this not inspiring you anymore, but it's gumming up your ability to create something you love creating. So I was able to kick it. I'm just lucky in that way that I can just flush a thing down the toilet and then it's over. Or, you know, not with cat. It took a few flushes, to be honest. But yeah. Yeah. But it's scary in that way. I think that's the big problem with it, is that it is a treatment for depression. And I think I was using it to cope with like a lot of like my dad's and my mom passing. And, you know, I think it was legitimately keeping me out of a long depressive episode. But just like what you're saying, you know, you can't isolate and do these things. This is why I think, you know, when people talk about psychedelic therapy, it seems like they forget that that involves a therapist. You know, it involves an expert who's there to be the person who can hopefully help you avoid all the sand traps that are out there when it comes to any of these substances. I mean, we all love bliss. Who can blame us?
Right, of course. And I mean, this is another one of the complicated aspects of psychoactive drugs and addiction, is sometimes someone who has no experience, they'll look at a news report of somebody who's freaking out after having consumed so-called bath salts or spice or something like that, and they think, oh, I'd never want to do that. What would drive a person to do that? Why on earth would the person do that? But what they're not recognizing is that was the worst time for that person. But previously, it was probably good. That's why they were doing it. It starts out good often, and then there can be a slow change that occurs where you either stop responding to it, or in addition to the good things, there's a bad thing, or it becomes entirely bad. And tracking that is, yeah, something that a therapist or a friend is really helpful for. Or I think the easiest way is just to try to do these things infrequently. That way you can track yourself.
Absolutely. And it's always better if you do it infrequently anyway. It's so much better to, like, I know that somewhere around the corner in a few years, it's not like I won't do ketamine again, but I also know that when I do it, it'll be wonderful because it's been a long time in between. And I think that, you know, that's our whole way of looking at addiction seems somehow, you know, tainted by the prohibition. I don't think people understand that there's actually a way that these substances can be used with very infrequently and successfully. And it doesn't mean that your whole life is going to fall apart after that. But I'm sure you must have had moments where you worry about the effect that your show is having. I mean, do you have that? Do you have some sense of like, look, like you're a disciplined person. You're able to modulate the way you use these substances, but sometimes with my podcast, and especially earlier episodes when I was, I think, very irresponsible in my bugling the benefits of psychedelics, I worry that, you know, I wasn't cautionary enough and that I might have, you know, I don't know. And even in a small way, I would hate to think that I led someone into a place they couldn't get out of.
Yeah. I think that I've been pretty good about specifying the dangerous aspects, or if not, I try to implicitly communicate that. So sometimes people will say, hey man, I watched your show and you showed this person who, they're a weirdo, they do ketamine and they're weird, that's not gonna end prohibition. You need to show Silicon Valley microdosers who are using it to empower their high productivity career, that's the way you change the narrative. And And one reason that I include people who are weird or who have beliefs that maybe, you know, from like a drug policy or advocacy perspective, these beliefs would not be the ones that most people would want to elevate and say, this is what happens when you use a drug. But one reason, in addition to just, I like talking to weird people, as you do as well.
Yes.
And so I'm not, you know, like making advertisements for psychedelics. I'm making documentaries about psychedelics. And in doing that, I want to show people who sometimes have strange beliefs, partially because I find it interesting, but partially to show, yeah, you know, these things do open your mind, and sometimes that's beneficial, and sometimes that might promote a type of thinking that maybe is undesirable to you. And this is what it looks like. You know, I got a lot of people criticized me for showing, you know, this guy that smoked DMT and believed in Pizzagate, and you know, saying how could you possibly do that? You're going to undo any progress. But, you know, if you only talk about Johns Hopkins University and academic research with psychedelics, you're neglecting to acknowledge the reality of psychedelic drug use for many people. So that's the way I try to handle it, is to show that, you know, to show honestly how these things exist in society and let people draw their own conclusions. So if you see somebody who's a, you know, a strange artist living alone in the desert who has a lot of outlandish beliefs about angels and UFOs and dolphins, who uses a lot of ketamine, and you think,
loved that episode,
and you think that's terrible, well, then there you go. Then you have. But if you think that's fantastic, then there you go as well. You know, that's kind of my take on it. And
fell in love with that guy.
Me too.
What was his name?
Timothy Wiley.
Wow, what a saint. That guy was, he had a, to me, and maybe it was just the lighting, he really seemed to have this ethereal glow about him. Like, he really seemed like some kind of, I don't know, awakened being or something.
Oh, well, you know, he was like a spiritual leader, you know, the Process Church.
Yes.
Yeah, he was a, you know, big part of the Process Church. He was behind the scenes in a lot of different things. You know, Genesis Peorage?
Yes.
Like, her transformation was because of Timothy Wiley.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Giving her ketamine and helping her, like, transform. So he was part of a lot of different things, and he was a really, you know, he was a true artist, a true weirdo, a true independent, strange thinker. And I love that. You know, I think that I don't want a reality that is so sterile that people only talk about these things as, you know, psychiatric medications for treatment of disease. I think that they're useful for expanding thought in directions that are strange and artistic. Yes. And poetic and weird. Why not? You know, it's this is all beautiful and good. And in the finale of my show last night, I profiled this woman, Amanda Fielding, who reminds me of Timothy Wiley in a lot of ways. You know, she's brilliant. She's a truly heterodox thinker who has spent her life in this quixotic quest to demonstrate that trepanation is a medically valid procedure. And while I don't think that trepanation is likely to be medically validated, although I'd be happy to be wrong, I think that part of it comes from a certain insecurity that many people have, that they need medical validation, when I see this as a sort of artistic decision that she made, a sort of body modification that is valid whether or not it has any impact on her consciousness, as something symbolic, as truly opening her head, opening her mind. You know, I think that there's something amazing about that, regardless of what physiological effect it may or may not have.
Listen, if anybody who has watched a documentary on trepanation and hasn't had at least the fleeting thought of, like, shit, maybe I should try that, that sounds awesome, I think you're not looking into it deeply enough. Trepanation is one of those things. The problem with it is, like, how do you go back? You know, what if you're wrong? But anytime I've seen these documentaries, I would never be, is it trepanated? Is that how you'd say it?
Yeah, or trepaned.
I would never be trepaned. But come on, aren't you curious about, like, what the effect is? This was, it's not just like this is something body modification people are doing. This was a cultural movement at one time, right? That this was something that was being practiced for centuries, right? Like, we're still finding skulls that have been trepanned.
Oh, yes. It's one of the oldest known surgical procedures.
Yeah, it's some form of what, like neurological bloodletting or something? Like, well, what is the idea? It relieves pressure on the brain, or it enhances mystical states? I haven't yet to see the finale, so sorry if I'm making you repeat something that's already
And the finale actually doesn't even go into the science of it, because I don't want to take a public stance on trepanation. You know, for the record, I do not imagine that it has, I don't predict that it has major therapeutic effects. You know, people routinely have holes drilled in their skulls for surgical procedures, you know,
right.
craniotomy. So it's not as if it's not done in the 21st century, and it doesn't seem to have a major effect. But, you know, and historically in these, you know, various artifacts that have been uncovered and these ancient skulls that have been trepanned, it makes a lot of intuitive sense. If you have a headache, well, where's the pain? It's in your head.
Right.
So where are you going to direct your medical intervention? To the head. You got to get out that demon that's in your head. You're insane.
Right.
There's something in your head. There's a problem in your head. You got to get it out. So right. it makes sense in this, you know, in intuitive understanding of the way the body works, especially from a spiritual framework where you're attributing disease to malevolent spirits.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Let me also emphasize, don't trepanate yourself or your friends or anybody. It's just a curious thing that has happened in the past. Also, you know, what was the anesthetic that they were using? I mean, maybe part of the, you know, experience in the past was the, you know, lack of any kind of anesthetic, as we, at least the ones we have access to now. Maybe there was some initiatory pain high that people were getting from it. But do you, you know, this is to me what, you know, I know you get it. Now I'm hearing that you get it, which is like the people who are very protective of what they see as some kind of, you know, flowering psychedelic renaissance. What do they call it? The third, I don't know. There's a name for the thing, and I've forgotten what it is. And there, people are rightfully protective of it. And I agree with you. It does seem to me to be right now, maybe necessarily imbalanced towards the medical universe, just so that it can get to the place where it can, you know, happily be used as a cultural amplifier, stimulant, or an inspiring kind of something that could, like, you know, shape movies and art and things like that. But the message I've gotten from people is more along the lines of, we don't need any more gurus. We don't need any more psychedelic Jesuses out there. What do you think is the weird connection between psychedelics and the messianic thing that seems to like happen to people? You know, like, we, inevitably someone emerges, you get a person who's taken enough acid that they really believe they're the Christ or the Maitreya or whatever, an alien representative. And weirdly, they end up with a group of people following them around because, you know, there is some kind of actual gravity these people have. But what are your thoughts on that? Do you have any thoughts on, like, the many psychedelic messiahs we've had in the past and certainly will have in the coming years?
Well, it depends on how you define messiah, because if you're including Timothy Leary there, I think Timothy Leary is very widely misunderstood. You know, the more I think about Timothy Leary, the more I think of him as a comedian. I really, you know, I think more than a psychologist, more than a guru, more than almost anything, Timothy Leary was a comedian. And he was someone who believed in psychedelics at a time when they were being attacked from every imaginable direction, medically, legally, socially. And he defended them. And the psychedelic community does not appreciate what he did, the sacrifices that he made. He's, you know, routinely criticized. People blame him for the end of psychedelic research. I think a lot of what we have today is not something that exists in spite of Timothy Leary, but because of Timothy Leary. And I don't really think he did anything wrong at all. I think that he was a victim of many. I mean, he was facing life in prison. They were threatening to lobotomize right. him. Like, can you imagine what he went through just because he was interested in LSD and cannabis?
No, I can't. And also, let me clarify, I love him. I've read much of his like writing, and some of his obscure writing is amazing. The Circuits of Consciousness. I really love him. I could see, though, why he gets criticized. I could see, I mean, they, you know, you want a scapegoat, you know, and he was, I guess, the loudest one that I could think of in that movement. Tune In, Turn On, Drop Out, an invitation to sort of exit capitalism. He would have, these days, he would have seemed like almost like a square, you know, he would have had a podcast, would have seemed cool. But in those days, yeah, he was a culture shatterer. I could see both sides of it. But do you know what I'm saying, though? Like, this is something I've noticed specifically with psychedelics, which is that you will meet people who have transformed themselves, legitimately healed themselves, people who have taken ayahuasca and have become peaceful, and people who are just have a kind of sweetness to them that they report being related to a series of experiences they had in a psychedelic. But weirdly, you run into these like people who somehow the thing is making them into egomaniacs. And it's one of the more confusing aspects of these drugs. It's just a bizarre thing to witness these people. And also because, you know, there's, I guess to reduce it to less than a messiah, what are your thoughts on this thing where the self-assignment of oneself as a shaman?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I would say I regard it with suspicion and distrust most of the time, as one should. And I think, again, like so many of the problems with drugs, they're not actually problems with drugs, they're problems with prohibition and cultural problems more than they are pharmacological ones. So, you know, if you think about it in the context of a society that says everything is bad, or says a thing is bad, and then you try it, and then you realize that not only is it not bad, it's good. And you think, okay, well, I'll make it my mission to tell everyone that it's good, actually.
Right.
I think that's kind of the basic thing that's operating in a lot of these people, is they have some transformative experience and they want to share it. I think it often is happening from a somewhat positive perspective, but then I think where it tends to go wrong is not when people are talking about the positives, but when people start to try to control behavior or try to coerce other people into doing things, or start creating a rigid set of beliefs that are used to create different types of moral dichotomies where you can criticize other people or say that they're doing something wrong. You know, that's, I think, where you really run into problems. And I've spent time with a lot of different religious groups that use psychedelics and indigenous groups that use psychedelics. And the ones that I think run into problems are the ones that start to dictate other people's behavior and force people to do things or force people to believe things. You know, there's a big difference between saying, I think you shouldn't eat meat because meat is requires violence to an animal and you should try to minimize the violence of your existence in any possible way, but it is your choice to eat meat, and saying, you know, you're a bad person, you're not enlightened, you're not spiritual, you're part of the problem if you eat meat. You know, I think part of using these things constructively and existing in the world constructively is to be permissive of other people's behavior as long as they're not hurting other people. And I understand that it's like, you know, it all comes into this kind of classic, you know, Socratic idea that no one knowingly does wrong. And so all these people are always thinking that they're doing the right thing. They're thinking, oh, no, you know, the problem with eating meat is it's so bad, or the problem with being gay is that it's really bad. God doesn't want you to be gay or whatever. They think they're doing the right thing. They're not operating from a perspective of wanting to contribute pain or evil into the world, but that's what happens when they're trying to do good. And you know, I got very close to a psychedelic cult for a while. I was writing a story about.
Can you say which cult?
I am not going to say their name because it went sour with them and like ended with sort of oblique death threats from them.
Oh, Jesus.
But I was, maybe I'll write something about it at some point. It was for an article in Harper's. This was like one of the things that was contributing to my depression in 2018. But anyway, you know, this group had a very strict code of conduct that I think that, you know, their psychedelic advocacy was wound up in control fantasies of the leader. And, you know, I think that's the major line. There's nothing wrong with being, you know, thinking you're a messiah, but I think there is something wrong with attempting to control other people or trying to or trying to make other people feel bad about their actions unnecessarily.
You know, there's a famous story Ram Dass tells, because his brother got institutionalized because his brother thought he was Jesus. They found him in an apartment. He had six elderly women around him worshiping him, and he was having a messianic delusion. Got institutionalized. Ram Dass tells a story. He goes to visit his brother in a mental hospital, and his brother says to Ram Dass, "Look at you. You know, you're dressed like Jesus. You have followers. People, you know, you're like a guru person. How come you're out there and I'm in here?" And Ram Dass's answer was, "Well, the difference is you think you're the only Jesus, and I think everyone's Jesus."
Uh-huh. That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But yeah, well, I mean, your encounter with this leader, did he demonstrate to you any qualities that were magnetic, or did you feel sort of, you know, vacuumed into his social gravity well?
My impression was that, you know, again, when you're part of a subculture, an underground group, you have beliefs that are not only not shared by the majority of people that surround you, they're illegal. You'll kind of go with whoever you can find. So this guy, I wouldn't say that his beliefs were especially unusual. They're just at that, this is someone who was operating starting in the, really in the 60s and continues to this day. But really just someone who believed in psychedelics and believed in nonviolence and believed in vegetarianism and believed in a lot of good things. And so that drew people in, not because he was necessarily charismatic or magnetic, but because they thought, oh, okay, well, here's a guy that at least gets what's going on. He understands the value of health food. He understands the value of meditation. He understands the value of psychedelics. He has liberal ideas about the importance of sex, you know, things like that. So I think that for a long time, you could cultivate a following just by not hating these things, basically.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, congratulations on getting out of that thing. You know, I think there's something to be said. I think it's a good sign if you have gotten vacuumed into a cult, and if, you know, that means you're living life, if you ask me. You know, and importantly, that you've also gotten out.
I should say, I was not, although I actually did try to join this cult as a freshman in college, I was never a member of this cult. I was involved with them via a strange series of connections and was ultimately trying to write a story about them because I, at the beginning, felt very sympathetic toward them. I felt that they had been, that they'd gone through horrible, horrible adversity in order to, you know, believe in psychedelics for decades. And they did. They, you know, that's like so many of these things. It's complicated. They really did fight for psychedelics at a time when very few other people were. And they were both persecuted and prosecuted by the government. And they, you know, understandably developed a number of different complexes as a result of it. But,
right.
But yeah, so I was trying to write a story about it. This was not as a member of the cult, thankfully.
Well, you should get into a cult, Hamilton. but hey, let me, to end on a kind of mundane question, what a wonderful conversation. I'm so grateful to you for being on the show. But what are your thoughts on, this is, by the way, speaking of like people who have gone through hell because of the war on drugs, who had the initial understanding that these things were medicines, that they had great potential and it got arrested, had their lives destroyed. I am so exhilarated by the reality that right now you can buy stock in companies that are, you know, synthesizing LSD and, you know, doing legal research on it. But I feel a little bitterness too. You know, it's like, oh, great. Now I can literally buy stock in a company doing experiments with LSD when not that long ago, if I had it in my pocket, well, to this day, if I had it, I'll go to jail. But do you feel that kind of bitterness? For me, there's like I don't know how to put it. There's just this feeling of like, yeah, we knew this. You know, we knew how many lives have been destroyed. How many people have lost their children? How many people have, you know, been like completely ostracized from society for, you know, just doing a thing that is ultimately like very beneficial to a person's life. Do you ever, do you get that feeling like, you know what I'm talking about? Like a kind of,
Of course. And, you know, this is what you're describing is a feeling you should have, because it's deeply contradictory, it's deeply disturbing, and at the same time, it's good. It's weird. It's a weird feeling. And it's, you know, of course, it happened first with cannabis. You have people becoming multimillionaires from cannabis at the same time that there are people locked in cages, isolated from their family, their lives destroyed for cannabis. This is happening right now as we speak. So, yeah, there's a deep and painful hypocrisy in that. And we're seeing it happen with psychedelics. And the weirdest thing about it is that it's a good thing, you know, that you look at this and you think this is deeply unjust. But it's even weirder to think this is actually the right thing to be happening, because this is progress. This is how things change. And this is the rate of change in our society. It doesn't happen overnight. In fact, it's happening a hell of a lot faster than I or almost anyone else thought it would. You know, that yes, that there are publicly traded psilocybin stocks that you can invest in on Robinhood right now. That's mind-boggling. And that, you know, like, for example, I've done chemistry research for over a decade at this small pharmacy school in Philadelphia. And in the past, there was a little bit of money from the university. I would, you know, self-fund the research. A few nice people, like, you know, Tim Ferriss gave me some money at one point for research. But, you know, for the most part, we were just, we barely had enough money for solvents to do this chemistry. And now there are so many pharmaceutical companies trying to hire me to do research, to be on their board of advisors. And yeah, it's like, it's a weird feeling, but I am also aware, wow, this is how things are going to change. Now, this isn't going to be a question of, oh, can I afford, you know, this reagent? Now people are going to be able to do so much research that they never could do before. So many of these, you know, multi-decade lasting questions about the potential of psychedelics, both positive and negative, are on the precipice of being answered. And it's going to be great. You know, I'm so excited for what's happening. I really am. I'm not an especially optimistic person. I am usually a somewhat pessimistic person, actually. But this forces a tiny bit of optimism out of me. And we'll of course, see how it all plays out. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of good things that can come out of it. Even if every pharmaceutical psychedelic fails, then maybe at least in this process, we will have taught people that these things do have at least medical potential, or that they shouldn't be illegal. And that would be tremendous progress that we will see in our lifetime. So I'm really excited. I'm excited to be a part of it. You know, I'm pretty much planning to, you know, I have a podcast and I'm going to continue doing that. I'm going to continue writing, but I'm planning to do a lot less of this documentary work in order to focus on chemistry, because the resources are available now. You know, now is the first time that this could be a full-time job, and it's so exciting.
Wow. But wait, you can't close saying that you're not going to do another season. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's funny. It's, you know, at the same time that all these resources are being made available for scientific research, the season was, I don't want to like close on something negative, but it was a Herculean task to finish it.
Right.
You know, for me and for the many people that worked on it, it was, you know, the consensus among most of the group was we could do it this time, you know, working 13, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, sacrificing everything to finish it, working unpaid, but that's not sustainable. You can do that.
Right.
You can do that for a year. You can't do that for the rest of your life. And so if some, you know, offer emerges that would change that would make it a reasonable thing that people wouldn't have to, you know, there was someone who was working on the show who had, you know, had a breakdown from the level of stress working on it. You know, I think it's wow. hard for people to fathom what went into that. So when people contact me and they say like, oh, why didn't you show, you know, you really should have shown xenon distillation. Why didn't you do that? It's like, well, because it was a pandemic and I wanted to, and it wasn't possible. And we were already completely out of money and like filming things on our iPhones. So, you know, so it was really, really hard, and I'm proud of a lot of what we all created, but I think now the time has come to do some chemistry, and I'm excited to do that.
Hamilton Morris, I love you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Everybody, Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia, season 3, it's on Amazon. Please watch it. It is a beautiful show, and I could tell that y'all sweated blood to create it, but thank you for making it. What's the name of your podcast, Hamilton?
It's my Patreon, patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. It doesn't have a name. It's really just a chemistry, mostly chemistry and psychoactive drug science podcast, and then some other assorted little projects. So yeah, people can check that out. And one final thing is I just republished this small book that I should send you a copy, Duncan, but it's a cool Please. Book about Boofwell Various. It was written by this guy, Ken Nelson. And it also has information about the synthesis of 5-MeO-DMT. And all of the profit from that goes to the Michael J. Fox Foundation. It's been this kind of amazing fundraising success where it's now raised like $120,000 for Parkinson's research. And that's still available. So if anyone wants to check that out, www.psychedelictoadofthesonorandesert.com.
Wonderful. All the links you need to find that will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Hamilton, thank you so much. And you're just the best.
You're the best. Let's talk again soon.
Okay, great. Hare Krishna. Thank you. That was Hamilton Morris, everybody. I hope that you will download season 3 of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors. Remember, by supporting them, you support us. And much thanks to my dear Patreon family. All right, pals, I'll see you next week. I hope you have a great weekend. And don't forget, starting Monday, I'll be back to our weekly meditation group, Journey into Boredom, at patreon.com/DTFH. I hope to see you there. Thanks for listening. Hare Krishna.